offensive operations against the Viet Cong. Admiral Sharp shared Wheeler's determination to expand the size and mission of U.S. ground forces. Wheeler told Sharp that one of the purposes of deploying an army division to South Vietnam would be to position forces of substantial size into forward areas in advance of expanded conflict. Sharp, receptive to Wheeler's suggestion, challenged Taylor's arguments against using Americans as counterinsurgents, saying that Taylor's remark that the American soldier, armed, equipped, and trained as he is not a suitable guerrilla fighter for Asian forests and jungles, ignored the Marine Corps' distinguished record in counter-guerrilla warfare. Wheeler assured Sharp that the president would soon approve the deployment of additional Marine units. He told the admiral that the deployment of the 3rd Battalion and the remainder of the brigade's command and support units had merely been deferred for later action. Wheeler assured Sharp that the president wanted to do everything possible to maximize our military efforts to reverse the present unfavorable situation. As Maxwell Taylor was arranging for a South Vietnamese request for U.S. Marines, the JCS were still trying to launch the first Rolling Thunder strike. 3 weeks had passed since the president's decision to begin continuous action against North Vietnam. But the unsettled political situation in Saigon and tight control from Washington had impeded the effort to begin the bombing. Washington retained the authority to cancel missions due to poor weather, and the JCS called off several planned strikes between February 22nd and March 2nd. Westmoreland told Wheeler that this form of control from Washington was absurd, considering that the weather changed faster than people in Vietnam could inform Washington of those changes. Last-minute orders and counter-orders from Washington continued to confound planning staffs and exhaust pilots, who had to remain on almost constant alert. Westmoreland asked for greater authority in orchestrating the airstrikes with other operations over which he enjoyed more control, such as the barrel roll, armed reconnaissance into Laos, and the Op Plan 34A covert raids into North Vietnam. In a prophetic closing, Westmoreland warned Wheeler that experience indicated that the more remote the authority which directs how a mission is to be accomplished, the more we are vulnerable to mishaps resulting from such things as incomplete briefings and preparation, loss of tactical flexibility, and lack of tactical coordination. Wheeler recognized the policy and procedural difficulties flowing from the close control of Rolling Thunder exercised by Washington, but he sensed that the time was not propitious for raising those issues with the president. What Wheeler regarded as most important was to get off this next Rolling Thunder to break what seems to be a psychological, political logjam. Wheeler urged Westmoreland to be patient and let him handle the political problem of control over Rolling Thunder. He assured Westmoreland that he and McNamara would do their best to clear away restrictions and relax Washington's tight control. He asked the MACV commander to be sensitive to the sizable and vexing domestic and international political considerations that impinged on operations against North Vietnam. Once Rolling Thunder was underway, Wheeler believed he would have greater success in removing the restrictions on the operation. He reminded Westmoreland of their successful effort to loosen control over Barrel Roll and Yankee Team air operations in Laos, like the decision to deploy the first U.S. ground combat units to South Vietnam. The systematic bombing of North Vietnam would begin without a comprehensive estimate of how much force would ultimately be required. Wheeler focused only on gaining permission to take the first step. On March 2nd, the initial mission of a bombing campaign that would last more than 3 years and drop 643,000 tons of bombs on North Vietnam was finally undertaken. U.S. Air Force and South Vietnamese aircraft struck North Vietnamese military facilities at Zam Bang and Quang Khe. The North Vietnamese, however, had used the 8 months since the Gulf of Tonkin reprisals to improve their air defense capabilities. 5 American and 1 South Vietnamese aircraft went down in flames. The beginning of Rolling Thunder revealed a wide disparity in expectations. Graduated pressure, an intentionally ambiguous strategy, permitted different interpretations of how the air campaign ought to be conducted and what it should achieve. Various senior members of the Johnson administration and the military had differing objectives for the air campaign, including forcing Hanoi to negotiate, coercing Hanoi either to reduce its support for or call off the insurgency, interdicting supplies and infiltration into South Vietnam, punishing Hanoi, boosting morale in South Vietnam, destroying North Vietnamese military capabilities, and protecting U.S. credibility by posing as the good doctor, trying his best to keep South Vietnam from succumbing to the disease of the Viet Cong insurgency. Deputy Secretary of State Ball had recognized the wide disparity in expectations for Rolling Thunder and sought clarification from the president. 3 weeks before the sustained bombing began, Ball urged LBJ to smoke out the differences among his colleagues. Although Ball and Llewellyn Thompson, also of the State Department, supported the bombing of North Vietnam, Ball emphasized what he considered important differences among the president's principal advisors. McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, and Taylor agreed that bombing North Vietnam would not only decrease infiltration from the north, but actually coerce Hanoi to call off the insurgency in the south and withdraw those elements infiltrated in the past. Ball thought that objective tantamount to demanding unconditional surrender, observing that, short of a crushing military defeat, Hanoi would never abandon the aggressive course it has pursued at great cost for 10 years and give up all the progress it has made in the communization of South Vietnam. Ball, a member of the American Strategic Bombing Survey Team of 1944 to 1945, which concluded that bombing had actually increased rather than decreased the resolve of the German people, was familiar with the inflated claims and expectations of air power enthusiasts. Instead of aiming to coerce Hanoi into foregoing its support for the Viet Cong, Ball suggested that the air campaign focus on interdiction. According to Ball, Bundy's and McNamara's expectations for the bombing would require escalation in pursuit of an elusive objective. Escalation, Ball warned, might lead to a ground war and nuclear confrontation with China. Although the bombing would not be decisive in itself, it would reduce the flow of supplies to the Vietnamese communist forces and boost morale in the South, enabling the South Vietnamese armed forces to cope better with the insurgency. Ball hoped to accomplish through negotiations what he thought unattainable through military action. After an unspecified period, an international agreement would permit the United States to reduce its involvement in the war. That agreement would, Ball hoped, stop the insurgency in South Vietnam and deliver the entire country south of the 17th parallel to the government in Saigon, free and clear of insurgency. Ball's expectations for diplomacy seemed as unrealistic as McNamara's, Taylor's, and McGeorge Bundy's expectations for air power. Although bombing advocates could see the weakness in Ball's hopes for a negotiated settlement, and although Ball viewed the expectations for the air campaign as unrealistic, all assumed that some combination of bombing and diplomacy would achieve a settlement in Vietnam more favorable than a U.S. withdrawal. Each sought to convince the president that his mix of diplomatic and military activity was most appropriate to the situation. Disagreements centered on the timing of negotiations. Ball urged that the United States go to the U.N. Security Council as soon as possible to call for a ceasefire and the end of support for the Viet Cong from the North. Taylor, McNamara, and Rusk thought that negotiations ought to be postponed until the United States had evidence that North Vietnam was hurting and was prepared to stop doing what it is doing against its neighbors. Ball's memo failed to inspire a reexamination of expectations for airstrikes against North Vietnam, and Rolling Thunder continued without a clear definition of what it was to accomplish. Ball found McGeorge Bundy and McNamara defensive about the air campaign. McNamara dismissed Ball's caveats concerning Rolling Thunder without discussion. McGeorge Bundy supported McNamara and argued that the absence of a clearly defined policy objective was a positive feature of the bombing campaign. Bundy told Ball that there was no need for the United States to follow a particular course down the road to a particular result. Bundy's belief had led him to support his brother's fallback objectives, discussed briefly in November 1964. Ball recalled that Bundy was qualifying the U.S. war aim declared in National Security Action Memorandum 288 on March 17, 1964, to maintain an independent, non-communist South Vietnam. He concluded that Bundy was leaving our objective unformulated and therefore flexible. Without a clearly defined objective, Ball said later, he and his colleagues were charging more deeply into the mire without clearly acknowledging where we were going and on what basis we would call a halt. Like Ball, McNaughton sensed the ambiguity of U.S. policy and attempted to clarify his own thinking about what the United States hoped to achieve in Vietnam, weighting each objective by percentage. 70% to avoid a humiliating U.S. defeat to our reputation as guarantor. 20% to keep South Vietnam and then adjacent territory from Chinese hands. 10% to permit the people of South Vietnam to enjoy a better, freer way of life. Also, to emerge from crisis without unacceptable taint from methods used. Not to help a friend, although it would be hard to stay if asked out. McNaughton, the principal civilian war planner in the Department of Defense, had abandoned the stated objective of maintaining a free and independent South Vietnam. For McNaughton, the objective of protecting American credibility had displaced the more concrete aim of preserving a free and independent South Vietnam. Even as Rolling Thunder began and Marines landed at Da Nang, McNaughton continued to plan for failure. He concluded that to avoid humiliation, the United States must be prepared to undertake a massive effort on the ground in Southeast Asia, involving the deployment of 175,000 ground troops. Even if the communists won, McNaughton believed that the United States would have protected its international image. On the occasion of an American defeat, the United States might use the following excuses: the chronic instability of the South Vietnamese government and the uniqueness and congenital impossibility of the situation. To cover its retreat from Vietnam, America might launch diversionary offensives elsewhere in the world or begin multi-nation negotiations for propaganda purposes. Although McNaughton repeated his belief that the likelihood of winning the war was small, all the United States had to do was get bloodied and hurt the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong to demonstrate to the world the lengths to which the United States will go to fulfill its commitments. McNaughton did not attempt to calculate how much blood it would take to protect American credibility. Although General Wheeler recognized that the lack of a clearly defined objective had created confusion among the command echelons between Washington and Saigon, he did not see clarification from the Secretary of Defense or the President. Wheeler continued to plan for deepening involvement in Vietnam under the assumption that the President and his advisors were pursuing the objective articulated in March 1964 to maintain an independent, non-communist South Vietnam. With that unqualified objective in mind, Wheeler believed that the United States would have to destroy North Vietnam's capability to support the insurgency in the South. Wheeler and the chiefs had resolved to do what they could within the constraints of graduated pressure, postponing aerial interdiction missions and attacks against radar and communications facilities until they could bomb targets north of the 19th parallel. Reluctant to use one of their bombing allocations on a low payoff target, they postponed the Rolling Thunder strike scheduled for March 11th because the most lucrative target was weathered in. American and South Vietnamese aircraft did not conduct the mission until 4 days later. Taylor, anxious to get Rolling Thunder underway, railed at the delay. Even as the chiefs focused on destroying North Vietnam's military capabilities, Taylor, like McNaughton, thought that the bombing should be aimed at strategic persuasion. Whereas McNaughton focused on demonstrating to Asia and the world that the United States was prepared to back up its commitments to the best of its ability, Taylor continued to believe that airstrikes would induce in the North Vietnamese leadership an attitude favorable to U.S. objectives. He believed that the JCS had placed too much importance on striking targets because of their intrinsic military value. He contended that the really important target is the will of the leaders in Hanoi, and that virtually any target north of the 19th parallel would convey the necessary message. Taylor lamented that repeated delays had failed to give the mounting crescendo to Rolling Thunder, which is necessary to get the desired results. Confusion over the objectives and nature of the air campaign, however, did not concern the president. President Johnson helped to preserve the confusion and lack of clear direction that attended the deepening American military involvement in the war. To achieve his primary goal, the preservation of the fragile consensus behind his Vietnam and domestic policies, his tactics included deliberate ambivalence, obfuscation, and subterfuge. Moreover, the ambiguous nature of his Vietnam policy bestowed certain advantages in the domestic political realm, permitting disparate constituencies to read into the president's policy what they wanted to. For those opposed to deepening the American commitment to Vietnam, Johnson would remain devoted to the pursuit of peace and would emphasize careful controls and tight restrictions on the use of military force. For the Joint Chiefs and others who pressed for more resolute military action, Johnson would appear tough and privately characterize initial military actions as first steps toward a much larger war effort. To both Doves and Hawks, he stressed continuity with the policies of previous administrations. For the Doves, he described the intensified American military role as essentially no different from the policies of Kennedy, Eisenhower, or even Truman. For the Hawks, he affirmed his commitment to save South Vietnam and help the South Vietnamese to preserve their freedom. Johnson moved to suppress any news of the shift in U.S. policy toward direct action against North Vietnam. On February 15th, New York Times reporter Tad Salk published a front-page article predicting that the Johnson administration would soon release a broad definition of its Vietnam policy and reveal a willingness to begin early negotiations with Hanoi. The president detected similarities between the article and George Ball's February 13th memo and was incensed. He telephoned Ball, describing the publication of the article as a crisis and demanded that the State Department determine the source of the leak. Johnson feared that a definitive policy statement would invite criticism from Hawks and Doves alike. He believed that Republicans, such as Senate Minority Leader Dirksen, would demand more resolute military action, while peacemakers, such as Democratic Senators Frank Church and George McGovern, would criticize any level of military force as dangerous and excessive. Faced with the danger of leaks revealing America's deepening involvement in the war to the Congress and the public, Johnson drew his advisory group even tighter. He warned Ball that he was going to put watches on the top people in the State Department, and even suggested that Senator Joseph McCarthy had been right in the 1950s when the Wisconsin Republican made sensational, unsubstantiated claims that the State Department was full of communist subversives. LBJ instructed Ball to obscure the changed nature of the war, demanding that, whenever possible, Rusk, Ball, and McNamara feed out enough repetition of what our position is so the folks won't say we don't tell them anything. Take the position. We have the same policy. We don't believe in moving out, and we are not. We do believe in helping other people defend themselves. We did this in the Gulf of Tonkin and when our soldiers were caught sleeping in their barracks. It does not change our policy or go north attitude. The president told Ball that if necessary, he would make all decisions by himself and get one man alone with him in the room and bar all others. The president's reluctance to discuss Vietnam in a forthright manner confused even his closest advisors. On February 16th, McGeorge Bundy told Johnson that he was unclear as to the firmness of your own decision to order continuing action and urged him to at least make the decision known to enough people to permit its orderly execution. Bundy explained that McNamara, too, was confused and needed to know where the president stood so that he could make his military plans and give his military orders. Bundy reminded Johnson that his policy was very different indeed from that of previous operations and recommended that the president reveal the bombing of North Vietnam to the public as a major watershed decision. Instead of taking Bundy's advice, Johnson intensified his effort to portray his policy as one of continuity with those of previous administrations. He met with Dwight D. Eisenhower. He briefly mentioned this meeting to the National Industrial Conference Board in a speech that, although it focused primarily on aspects of the Great Society, did mention Vietnam. As I have said so many, many times, and other presidents ahead of me have said, our purpose, our objective there is clear. That purpose and that objective is to join in the defense and protection of freedom of a brave people who are under attack that is controlled and that is directed from outside their country. On the same day, Harry S. Truman issued a statement in support of Johnson's Vietnam policy. Johnson's effort had the desired effect. The New York Times published photos of Johnson with Eisenhower on the front page, and an accompanying article reported broad Republican support for Johnson on Vietnam. Republican senators had remained the president's principal concern because, if dissatisfied over Vietnam, they might join with conservative Democrats to derail the Great Society. During his meeting with Johnson, Eisenhower told the president that the U.S. government must tell our people just what we are doing, what our policy is, and what course of action we are following. Even with Eisenhower's support in hand, however, Johnson remained determined to avoid clearly defining his policy in Vietnam. Doves heard restraint in his promise to take only measured and fitting actions that are justified and made necessary by the continuing aggression of others. Hawks were reassured by his pledge to persist in the defense of freedom. Those who questioned the direction of LBJ's policy were excluded from future deliberations on Vietnam. Vice President Humphrey, impressed by recent intelligence estimates that questioned whether bombing North Vietnam would persuade Hanoi to end the insurgency, asked his former senatorial assistant, Thomas Hughes, to brief him on the current situation in Vietnam. On February 1st, Hughes, then director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, carried the latest CIA and special national intelligence estimates with him to meet Humphrey, who was vacationing in Georgia. When the vice president returned to Washington, he forwarded a memo to LBJ, saying that he would support any presidential decision on Vietnam, but felt obligated to apprise the president of his growing concern about the deepening U.S. involvement in the war. He observed that the Truman and Eisenhower administrations had not been able to sustain public support during the Korean War, and argued that the situation in Vietnam was fraught with even greater difficulties. He told Johnson that there was little hope for success, and warned, as Ball had earlier, that the United States would become the prisoner of events in Vietnam. He suggested, as Senator Russell had in November, that the president's landslide victory had put the administration in a stronger position to distance the United States from the war than any administration in this century. Humphrey added that pulling out of Vietnam would present minimal political risk to the administration, and warned that, on the contrary, a slow escalation of American involvement would lead to considerable political opposition. Johnson responded by excluding Humphrey from further deliberations on Vietnam. Johnson's other advisors considered Humphrey's treatment an object lesson. Ball later recalled that, faced with a unanimous view among the president's top advisors, he saw no option but to go along. Although Ball would attempt to postpone and minimize the scope and intensity of the bombing, he would no longer question the general direction of the policy or the assumptions that underlay it. He and others had come to the paradoxical conclusion that to protect their influence with the president, they had to spare him their most deeply held doubts. If they voiced their reservations, they would join Humphrey in exile. Chapter 12. A Quicksand of Lies. March to April, 1965. The Constitution assigns to Congress the right to declare war. How can Congress discharge this function if its members and the citizens who have elected them are precluded from discussing the merits of the issues that might lead to war? The Constitution implies that Congress has a choice in the matter of war. How can it make that choice if neither it nor the people it represents have the right to debate the issues? To say that the most momentous issues a nation must face cannot be openly and critically discussed is really tantamount to saying that democratic debate and decision do not apply to the questions of life and death, and that, as far as they are concerned, the people have given carte blanche to one man. Not only is this position at odds with the principles of democracy, but it also removes a very important corrective for governmental misjudgment. Hans Morgenthau, April 3, 1965. The movement toward war seems, in retrospect, to have been inexorable, largely because LBJ succeeded in minimizing the participation of Congress in his decisions that escalated American military involvement in Vietnam. McNamara, reflecting on the decisions of the spring and early summer of 1965, recalled that we were sinking into the quicksand. It was, however, a quicksand of his and the president's making, a quicksand of lies. The support of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would prove crucial to LBJ's and McNamara's efforts to conceal the changed nature of American involvement in Vietnam. On March 1st, the New York Times reported that Johnson had begun a continuing but limited air war against North Vietnam to force a negotiated settlement on honorable terms. On March 2nd, the day after Taylor received permission from the Saigon government to land Marines at Da Nang, reporter Sulk quoted administration officials revealing the president's decision to deploy a 1,200-man Marine battalion landing team. The article reported that the Marines would be assigned to guard air bases and other installations in areas where Viet Cong guerrillas are particularly active, but would not be sent into combat. The stories incensed Johnson. He issued a strong rebuke to the military through McNamara, who sent a message directly to General Westmoreland, describing the leaks to the press as irresponsible, if not insubordinate. McNamara was taking action to prevent similar occurrences in the future, including the application of severe disciplinary penalties, and he asked Westmoreland to do the same in Saigon. The president called the Army Chief of Staff to the White House to express his dissatisfaction with the leaks and to charge General Johnson with reassessing the situation in Vietnam. Joining the general and the president were Rusk, McNamara, and McNaughton. LBJ indicated that he was willing to look with favor on a recommendation for the deployment of more U.S. ground combat units to Vietnam. Like McGeorge Bundy's trip in February, Harold Johnson's visit to South Vietnam would legitimize a military action for which strong sentiment already existed among the president and his closest advisors. His trip would give the JCS a sense of participation in the policy process. Over breakfast at the White House, the president told General Johnson to return with recommendations that would boost the counterinsurgency effort in South Vietnam without drawing public attention to the escalation of the war. LBJ made it clear to the general that his domestic political concerns would not permit a large-scale troop deployment. The president suggested that, after the 1st Marine Battalion landed, the next increment of troops consist of two Army rather than Marine Corps battalions, thinking that the deployment of Army units would blur the distinction between combat formations and advisors already in Vietnam and produce a lower noise level. After breakfast, the general joined LBJ on the elevator. As Harold Johnson was about to part company with his commander-in-chief, the president leaned down, pushed his forefinger into the general's chest, and said, "Get things bubbling." Johnson's instructions included 28 possible actions to discuss with Westmoreland, Taylor, and their staffs on arrival in Saigon. Although the president had initially directed the general to consider the possibility of deploying ground forces, LBJ ordered that passage deleted from the general's written instructions. General Johnson's team consisted of 11 men, including McNaughton and Lieutenant General Goodpaster. Because Johnson's visit was so short and its focus so broad, he did not have time, actually, to reassess the situation there, but only to compile more actions to take inside and outside South Vietnam. Johnson was inundated with information from various agencies that briefed him on more than 60 topics. After only 4 days in Saigon, he was already saturated with information. He committed only one full day to visits with U.S. advisors and South Vietnamese officials in the field. He stopped at 8 locations in that short period and had only 30 minutes per stop, which left little time for more than introductions and brief chats. Johnson found Taylor and Westmoreland pessimistic about the prospects for improvement in the situation, but fully committed to additional U.S. action. Although Taylor acknowledged the extreme dedication of the Viet Cong to their cause and the apathy among the South Vietnamese, he focused on the infiltration problem and urged an intensification of barrel roll and Rolling Thunder air operations in Laos and against North Vietnam. He continued to resist further troop deployments, but conceded that U.S. combat units might be needed eventually to offset shortages in the South Vietnamese Army. Johnson found Westmoreland more receptive than Taylor to the introduction of more troops into South Vietnam. At the end of a long day of briefings, Johnson asked everyone to leave the room except the generals. He then told them that President Johnson was not convinced that air power alone could reverse the downward trend in South Vietnam. "I am here as a representative of the President of the United States, who was making the momentous decision to commit American ground combat units on a large scale to South Vietnam. Westmoreland believed that defeat in Vietnam was imminent and recommended to General Johnson that the U.S. take whatever actions are necessary, including the deployment of additional ground combat units, to postpone indefinitely the day of collapse. The Army staff had already accomplished some planning of its own. Harold Johnson had long believed that the deployment of ground troops to Southeast Asia should precede any airstrikes against the North. He wanted well-equipped and well-trained Army units ready to fight if the situation continued to deteriorate in South Vietnam. In February, Johnson had sent his operations deputy, Lieutenant General Palmer, to South Vietnam. Palmer had found the South Vietnamese Army inept, poorly led, and incapable of fighting effectively against the Viet Cong, and told Johnson that the United States had two choices: withdraw or direct intervention on the ground. The Army staff had concluded then that a five-division force would be necessary. One division would occupy the Central Highlands and also establish secure enclaves on the coast, while the other four, three U.S. and one South Korean, would interdict the main infiltration route, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, from positions in Laos and along the demilitarized zone in South Vietnam. Johnson's trip to Vietnam confirmed Palmer's findings. In the northern half of South Vietnam, the Viet Cong had cut almost all of the transportation routes, limiting government control to the major cities. In Kon Tum province, government forces had abandoned several districts completely. The only means of supply into the high plateau was by air. In short, the South Vietnamese government controlled only a small part of the population, concentrated in the coastal urban centers. In addition to almost routine accounts of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam defeats at the hands of the Viet Cong, Westmoreland reported that North Vietnamese regular army regiments had infiltrated into the Central Highlands and were preparing for a large-scale offensive. On his return to Washington, General Johnson reported that U.S. ground forces would have to intervene directly in the counterinsurgency. Although the general remained a private critic of the air campaign, he argued that the slow tempo and self-imposed restrictions on the bombing of North Vietnam had severely reduced its effectiveness and made the successful execution of four Rolling Thunder missions per week virtually impossible. He submitted a list of 21 recommendations that included requests for an elimination of Washington's control over targeting and munitions, the deployment of additional helicopter companies, the construction of airfields, and an intensification of covert operations against North Vietnam. Johnson based his list of actions on McNaughton's memo and on discussions with General Westmoreland and Ambassador Taylor. Johnson provided no strategic concept, however, to lend coherence to his list of actions, and his report did not demonstrate how those actions would resolve what Taylor identified as the central difficulty in Vietnam: popular apathy and no popular commitment to the South Vietnamese government. The general warned LBJ that temporizing or expedient measures will not suffice, but all the suggestions that he offered the president were expedients aimed at averting immediate disaster in Vietnam. Although Johnson had predicted in December that it would take 5 years and 500,000 troops to win in Vietnam, he also agreed with Westmoreland's appraisal that the United States should take whatever actions are necessary to buy time. Once the impending disaster in Vietnam was averted, the general and his colleagues could press for further deployments. Westmoreland had shared with Johnson his observation that the president's policy had evolved into one of gradually and incrementally intensifying the war. He suggested that the military support LBJ's policy as long as the president remained committed to do whatever is necessary militarily to prevent defeat. General Johnson agreed. Instead of recommending that the president deploy five divisions, the level of force he and army planners felt was necessary to achieve a free and independent South Vietnam, he made the politically feasible recommendation for one division, as long as the others were added later. Years afterward, he regretted that he did not push for the deployment of the 4-Division Anti-Infiltration Force. Johnson's colleagues on the JCS were anxious to take full advantage of any opportunity to intensify the military effort. While General Johnson was in Vietnam, the JCS submitted separate memoranda urging approval for hot pursuit of the Viet Cong across the Cambodian border and a relaxation of restrictions on Farmgate, Op Plan 34A activities, and U.S. airstrikes within South Vietnam. The chiefs thus attempted to remove gradually the barriers to more resolute military action. They pursued that course without thinking about how, collectively, those actions fit together to accomplish their objective, for they had already accepted working within the flawed strategy of graduated pressure, which discouraged such considerations. By the time Johnson and his team returned to Washington on March 12th, the president had already discussed the introduction of additional ground forces with his civilian advisors. On March 5th, McGeorge Bundy, McNamara, and Rusk met to consider contingencies in the event of a sharp deterioration in the situation in Vietnam. After the meeting, in a personal and sensitive memorandum, Bundy felt it necessary to assure the president that he and his colleagues had not generated any paperwork and that the discussions had been closed to everyone but the three of us and one subordinate each. On March 9th, as the Marines landed at Da Nang, McNaughton returned early from the trip to South Vietnam and reported to Bundy that the situation there was troubled and the prognosis grim. He suggested that the president consider sending lots of troops to prevent the collapse of South Vietnam. Bundy invited McNaughton to join him, McNamara, Rusk, and the president for that day's Tuesday lunch, at which the former law professor gave the president the same assessment. On March 10th, during a meeting at Camp David with McGeorge Bundy, McNamara, and Rusk, LBJ concluded that to withdraw from Vietnam would be the equivalent of British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler at Munich in 1938, resolving that, come hell or high water, we're going to stay there. McGeorge Bundy recalled that the president had decided to do whatever he had to do, but he had not decided how much he had to do. 2 days later, General Johnson and his team returned from Vietnam. On March 15th, the president called the JCS to the White House for consultation. Although he continued to delay approval for the deployment of additional ground forces, he talked tough and convinced the Joint Chiefs that he was committed to taking any action necessary to preserve South Vietnam. Even as he postponed his decision on ground troops, LBJ made concessions to the chiefs in other areas and held out the promise of more decisive military action in the future. The president loosened controls on Rolling Thunder, approved most of the actions contained in Harold Johnson's report, and charged the chiefs with finding ways to improve the military situation in the South. He ended the meeting with a pep talk. He told his military officers that he wanted them to employ any means necessary to kill more Viet Cong. He expected a weekly report totaling the Viet Cong dead. The meeting did nothing to clarify U.S. objectives in South Vietnam or determine what level of military force would ultimately be required to meet those objectives. The president's tough talk, however, galvanized the chiefs and convinced Wheeler that his commander-in-chief was committed to do everything possible to better our situation in Vietnam. When the chiefs endeavored to carry out the president's instructions, inter-service differences over how to fight the war in Vietnam resurfaced. General Greene put forward a plan for the establishment of 6 beachheads, similar to his proposal of February 1964. The Commandant's plan would guarantee Marine participation in Vietnam in large numbers. Greene had suspected the Army of trying to minimize the Marines' role in Vietnam. His concept emphasized securing logistical bases adjacent to the sea from which U.S. forces could strike inland. Wheeler set the Joint Staff to work on a proposal that would deploy the remainder of the Marine Expeditionary Force to Da Nang and place 1 U.S. and 1 South Korean Army division in the Central Highlands to take an active role in counterinsurgency operations. Air Force Chief of Staff McConnell was opposed to both Wheeler's and Greene's proposals and continued to argue that airstrikes against North Vietnam would be decisive only if the bombing restrictions were lifted. To carry out his unrestricted air campaign, McConnell proposed accelerating the deployment of 4 additional squadrons to Southeast Asia. Instead of recommending more troops, McConnell contended that the JCS should urge immediate and more forceful application of air power against the source of Democratic Republic of Vietnam strength. He envisioned intensified bombing within the South to destroy Viet Cong concentrations, while more Air Force and Navy jets pounded vulnerable resources of the enemy in the North. Under McConnell's plan, Marine Corps and Army units would guard air bases and logistical facilities and aid the South Vietnamese Army's counterinsurgency efforts. Although the Joint Chiefs had concealed their differences from the Secretary of Defense and the President, they failed, as usual, to reconcile any of the disagreements because of their inability to overcome service parochialism. While the chiefs were divided, McNamara retained the initiative in planning the air war against North Vietnam. As a result of the chiefs delaying, and without their prior approval, the Joint Staff briefed McNamara on a 12-week program of military activities. It called for a 3-week interdiction campaign south of the 20th parallel, followed by a more comprehensive bombing program against the transportation network and radar facilities throughout North Vietnam. McNamara and the Air Force had begun Rolling Thunder as a campaign of strategic persuasion aimed at coercing North Vietnam to end its support for the insurgency in the South. The Joint Staff proposal marked a shift from that strategic objective to the tactical mission of interdicting the flow of supplies to the Vietnamese Communist forces in South Vietnam. The chief's confusion about the objectives and scope of the bombing persisted. On March 27th, all that Wheeler could do was to tell McNamara that the JCS was continuing to study alternatives. In mid-April, the JCS, still unable to reach agreement, referred the matter back to their staff. Meanwhile, sharp restrictions on the air campaign continued. The president's exhortation to kill more Viet Cong was aimed more at appeasing the chiefs than reflective of a genuine willingness to remove constraints on military activity. Although Rolling Thunder 7, the first strikes following General Johnson's report, lacked specific restrictions, such as Washington's approval to attack alternate fixed targets, the president imposed more general constraints that negated those changes. LBJ directed that the JCS avoid air operations in North Vietnam that might lead to clashes with North Vietnam's MiG fighters. That general restriction obliged General Wheeler to limit air operations to the area of North Vietnam south of the 20th parallel. Reconnaissance aircraft and fighter escorts could operate between the 19th and 20th parallels, but had to withdraw immediately upon detecting MiG fighters. The contradiction between the president's tough talk in the meeting with the JCS and the continuation of restrictions on the use of force confused General Greene. After their meeting with the president on March 15th, Greene told his JCS colleagues that the Marine Force at Da Nang was ready to commence offensive killing operations within 24 hours. On Friday, March 19th, Green noted that the president had wanted a report on what measures had been taken to kill more Viet Cong and could not understand why no orders had gone out to satisfy his desire. The other chiefs shared Green's confusion and, on the same day, decided to press Johnson to deploy additional ground forces and expand the mission of those forces to include offensive operations. Under the JCS proposal, the first additional units to deploy would be the remainder of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, or MEF, totaling 39,000 Marines. In addition, the chiefs urged the approval of Harold Johnson's fallback proposal for the deployment of one U.S. Army division, 26,000 troops, to the Central Plateau area for offensive operations and the deployment of the South Korean or ROK division of 21,000 troops. McConnell, who had opposed Army deployments, agreed to support the memorandum in exchange for a Joint Chiefs of Staff recommendation that the president intensify the air war against North Vietnam and approve the deployment of 9 more Air Force squadrons. Without ground forces along the demilitarized zone and in Laos, the Air Force would thus retain primary responsibility for the interdiction effort. As they had in the past, the chiefs sought an expansion of the war effort while suppressing doubts about the effectiveness of those intermediate steps. The justification was short-term. Wheeler warned McNamara that this direct military action was essential if defeat was to be avoided. Ambassador Taylor, however, continued to oppose Westmoreland's and the chief's proposals for expanding the numbers and broadening the mission of ground combat units in Vietnam. Wheeler pressed Westmoreland to request additional troops without regard for preserving the past policy of advising the South Vietnamese. But the MACV commander had to move cautiously, for he and Taylor had clashed when the 1st Marines landed in Da Nang. At that time, Taylor reminded Westmoreland that he was in charge of the military effort in Vietnam. Westmoreland, therefore, had to limit his recommendations for the time being to whatever forces Taylor would allow. On March 18th, Westmoreland persuaded Taylor to endorse a request for a 3rd Marine Battalion. Taylor gave in to Westmoreland's request in the hope that the battalion would comprise the final American troop deployment. As Westmoreland sent his request to the JCS, Taylor cabled Rusk, emphasizing the numerous disadvantages of sending additional forces to South Vietnam. He warned of greater losses and an increase in American vulnerability to communist propaganda and third world criticism, as we appear to assume the old French role of alien colonizer and conqueror. He conceded that the introduction of an army division would make some contribution to the war effort, but warned that U.S. forces would encourage the South Vietnamese to pass the Viet Cong burden to the U.S. He argued that there were problems with each of the locations where ground troops might deploy. The introduction of an American division to the Central Highlands, an area controlled by the Viet Cong, permits one to entertain the possibility of a kind of Dien Bien Phu. A coastal enclave mission would involve U.S. troops in an inglorious static defense mission, unappealing to them and unimpressive in the eyes of the Vietnamese. U.S. troops operating in major population areas would maximize the possible points of friction with the people. Westmoreland, however, was more concerned about recent battlefield defeats inflicted on the South Vietnamese Army than impressed by Taylor's arguments against the deployment of U.S. troops. Wheeler and Westmoreland began to work together to overcome the ambassador's opposition to ground combat troops. As the chiefs recommended to McNamara that the remainder of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, one U.S. Army division, and one Republic of Korea division deployed to South Vietnam with the mission of conducting counterinsurgency combat operations, Wheeler solicited from Westmoreland and Sharp their estimates of the logistical requirements and command arrangements necessary to implement the proposal. Wheeler requested that Westmoreland and Sharp keep the JCS proposal secret and limit planning actions to the smallest possible U.S. military, repeat, military group, until he had an opportunity to press his recommendations with the president. Meanwhile, Johnson's closest civilian advisors had become convinced that the introduction of U.S. ground forces to Vietnam was necessary and sought to portray Taylor's views as emotional and illogical. As early as March 6th, McGeorge Bundy, who advocated the introduction of ground forces to improve the U.S. bargaining position in Vietnam, recommended to the president that Taylor be replaced no later than June 1st. Bundy noted that although Taylor's prestige had been instrumental in keeping American opinion from division and criticism, the ambassador had become rigid, remote, and sometimes abrupt. Bundy thought that Taylor's deputy, Alexis Johnson, would be the best replacement and that a younger man, such as McNaughton, would be an ideal choice for deputy ambassador. In a thinly veiled criticism of Taylor's performance, McGeorge Bundy told the president that what the United States needed was an ambassador who understood the essentially political nature of the problem and applied himself to decentralized action with U.S. advice, assistance, and support at every level. Until Taylor's one-year tenure was up, however, the president felt he needed the ambassador's support to preserve the delicate consensus behind his Vietnam policy. Moreover, Taylor would have to gain South Vietnamese approval for U.S. ground troop deployments. As he contemplated candidates to succeed Taylor, Johnson asked the ambassador to return to Washington at the end of March for another round of interdepartmental consultations on Vietnam. On March 29th, Taylor joined McNamara and the JCS for a meeting at the Pentagon. The ambassador and the chiefs disagreed about how many U.S. troops should be deployed to Vietnam and how those troops ought to be used. In an estimate of the situation sent to Washington in advance of Taylor's arrival, Westmoreland supported Wheeler's proposals to change the mission of American forces from maintaining security in the South to conducting active counterinsurgency operations and to introduce a three-division force to secure coastal areas and fight communist forces in the Central Highlands region. Taylor, however, remained opposed to additional ground forces. He thought that a three-division force was too large and argued that the South Vietnamese government did not think that U.S. troops were necessary. Taylor again warned that U.S. troops would trigger latent anti-American sentiments among many South Vietnamese. If additional forces did deploy to South Vietnam, Taylor argued that their mission ought to be carefully circumscribed. He recommended that U.S. troops occupy secure enclaves along the coast and in the highlands, leave the preponderance of the fighting to the South Vietnamese, and conduct offensive operations only as a mobile reserve force. Harold Johnson disagreed with Taylor, observing that poor intelligence would result in quick reaction strikes falling on air rather than on the Viet Cong. General Johnson, countering the ambassador's proposal, suggested that U.S. ground forces establish model pacification programs in the three plateau provinces northwest of Saigon to provide security, undertake political reforms, and enhance economic development. Taylor's meeting with the JCS resolved little. Although McNamara believed that some U.S. troops were needed, he agreed with Taylor's assessment that three divisions seemed high. McNamara, who still wished to control carefully each incremental increase in the use of force in Vietnam, recommended that only two additional Marine battalions deploy to redress the adverse force ratios between the Viet Cong and the South Vietnamese armed forces. He suggested that if the situation required more troops, an additional brigade or division could follow the Marines at a later date.